You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast. Today is the 20th of June. And our big topic today was this new global study by the Reuters Institute that shows that more people are turning away from news. They describe it as depressing, relentless, and boring. So before you switch off, we asked on the radio today, what do you want from your news? We had two really interesting guests, Emmy award-winning Faraz Javid, who has worked as a journalist here in the UAE, but now is based in the States. He told us all about why he believes traditional news still has a future. And we spoke to Ahmed Al-Marzouki. Now, he's our digital native. He creates content and news online. He works for a company called Emirates Loves, who mainly focus on positive news. So it was really interesting to get his viewpoint on this as well. It's a great listen, definitely worth catching up with both of their commentary. Now, worrying numbers of pilgrims in Mecca are collapsing from heat exhaustion as temperatures soar to nearly 52 degrees in the Grand Mosque. And scammers are targeting Hajj visitors. We looked into both of those stories. Plus, with so many of us planning holidays, we found out how best to spend your money while avoiding fees. That was with the independent financial coach Steve Cronin. And 1 year since the Titan submarine was destroyed on a mission to the wreck of the Titanic, deep oceanic exploration continues. We spoke to Professor Alistair Grieg, who's a professor of marine engineering at the University College London, about whether this exploration can ever be safe. And if you enjoy this podcast, please do click subscribe so you never miss a single episode. Plus, remember, you can always get in touch with us. Just check out our social media. You can either go to Dubai Eye 103.8 FM. That's on Instagram or Facebook, or you can check mine out at georgia.tolley. Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. And we're kicking off today's programme with some rather worrying news, or at least for those of us here on the radio, because a new study has found that news, which is what we do on this show, makes people depressed. Do I make you depressed? And as a consequence, many people actively avoid it. It's a report by Oxford University's Reuters Institute, really well respected. And it found that almost 40% of people worldwide say they sometimes or often actively avoid the news. And that is compared with 29% in 2017. And as I said on the Business Breakfast, that trajectory is well depressing. The reports said that the wars in Ukraine and the Middle East may have contributed to people's desire to switch off the news. We wanted to get a sort of mix of views on this, and lots of people have been getting in touch with us ever since I mentioned the topic on the Business Breakfast. Have a listen to the views of these people.
These days, I rely on Facebook and other social media platforms. It's just easier that way. I just make sure that I follow reputable sites like CNN, BBC, so I don't fall prey to misinformation.
I've kind of stopped trusting the traditional media channels nowadays. I'd rather trust news from people who are based on the ground. Yes, it is depressing, but it's also important to see that and get your information straight.
I just check for industry news related to my job and for the clients that we cater to, that we handle.
I do not avoid depressing news. I think it's very important in our current scenario to be very informed of what's happening around you, even if you're not living in the same country.
I rely on social media for news and latest updates. When it comes to avoiding news because it's depressing, I would disagree. I would rather be more aware of the world that we're living in. So I choose to tune in, no matter how that makes me feel, because it just makes me more informed.
Okay, so apparently those who are still interested in news are actually ditching traditional media for platforms like YouTube, WhatsApp, and of course TikTok. And globally, in the 18 to 24 year age group, almost one in four people are getting their news from TikTok. The lead author of the study, Nick Newman, told BBC News a little bit more about its findings.
We're seeing a lot of change, a lot of increased complexity in the media landscape around the world. So online, social media, competing for people's attention. And sort of part of the, one of the consequences of that is that people are feeling a bit overwhelmed and confused by all these different sources. So I think that's part of the story. So that's not to say they're not consuming the news, but maybe they're trying to protect themselves from the depressing news agenda we've just been hearing about, the war in the Middle East and Ukraine. So some of these things are playing into it, as well as the cost of living crisis, COVID that came before. So there's a lot of factors at play here.
Now we're joined by an award-winning journalist to share his thoughts. Faraz Javid worked as a journalist and producer right here in Dubai before moving to the United States, where he currently works with ABC News Detroit, and he recently won an Emmy for his live coverage of a campus shooting in Michigan last year. He was one of the few reporters to arrive at the location when the shooting was taking place. Thank you so much for joining us, Faraz. Congratulations on the Emmy.
Thank you very much, Georgia. And listen, this happened Sunday, all right? I got the news, so I'm still really
in disbelief. Oh my gosh, you're still on cloud nine.
You're right.
Amazing. I mean, God, really, congratulations. It is
fantastic.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.
And I suppose your story there, your winning of that Emmy, really highlights the importance of trusted traditional media sources. Tell me a little bit more about the day when you were covering that live incident.
So it's interesting because, you know, born and raised here in Dubai, I have never witnessed any kind of shooting, all right? And that's a luxury that folks here in the UAE enjoy over pretty much any other country. Right? You never have we ever seen any sort of mass shooting or a serious crime over here. And thank God, and I hope you never see that. So moving to Detroit, I had never seen, experienced anything like this. And when I arrived on the scene, I still remember that I just finished about a story about a UFO, a story for another day. And I'd come home and I get calls from sources saying that there is an active shooter at Michigan State University. And so I hadn't heard anything about it at that point. All I was getting some information. So anyways, I reached out to some of my law enforcement counterparts in terms of sources, and they were able to verify that an active scene is taking place. I reached out to my newsroom and we were off to East Lansing. And if folks are not aware of Michigan, East Lansing and Detroit is like going from Dubai to Abu Dhabi. That's how far it is. And so on our way to East Lansing, where the Michigan State University campus is, we saw trucks of SWAT personnel, trucks of SWAT team just rushing to the site. Now, we talked about 70 law enforcement agencies responded that night. The shooting, the incident started at about like 8 p.m., right? So by the time we got there, it was 11. We do not know at that point how many shooters were there. We do not know how many victims. We were getting word of at least 10 people that were injured, multiple fatalities. However, that was changed later on when officials came up and shared the news with us, fact-checked, vetted, and we were able to sadly verify that 3 people sadly did succumb to the injuries and 5 were injured. I was also one of the few reporters, if not the first reporter, to arrive on the scene where the shooter shot himself when he was confronted by the police. And so, you know, being there, witnessing all of this, the uncertainty, the fact that you don't know what's coming next, that was scary for everyone. Not only for, you know, folks on campus. And we're talking about a campus of 80,000 people, students, faculty members, staff, and then journalists like us. We're there. We're trying to find information so we can share it with people.
And I suppose the difference between you as a journalist and sort of all the other citizen journalists, which is sort of what we call them in the industry, basically just observers, before you put anything on Twitter, before you put anything on the news, you fact check it. And the tradition for a journalist is to fact check it twice. So you get 2 sources, unless you are seeing it yourself and you have to be that trusted journalist. But while you were reporting on that story with the facts, I imagine there were swirls of rumors going around social media. And that just serves to prove how important it is to have solid, trusted journalists covering these stories. Because I imagine the misinformation was manifold.
101%. The misinformation was what was basically wasted a lot of resources. I mean, we were talking about people were calling in and reporting multiple gunshots heard at locations where there was no active scene. Mm. Police officers were responding to those scenes because they didn't want to take a risk at all. They didn't want to take any chance. So they were responding. And remember, these resources are now being wasted. People were sharing information that were factually incorrect. People were sharing information for folks to, you know, be at a certain location where the police didn't want anyone to be. So these are just some of the many things where misinformation is shared online because, once again, as you said, it is not fact-checked. It is not vetted. And that's exactly what we journalists do.
Are you worried when you hear about surveys like this that suggest that basically the public, people, don't really want the news anymore? You've got 46% of people saying that they are interested in the news, but that is down from 63% in 2017.
It is shocking. I mean, if you think about it, the news, in my opinion, is extremely vital for people to listen. And I'm not saying don't take it from social media, because there are credible sources on social media as well. I think the key is credible sources. That's what you want to go. So if it's a news outlet that's sharing information, if it's a trusted journalist that's sharing information, that's absolutely fine. Because once again, this is information that's vetted, fact-checked, and it's provided with accuracy. You cannot refute it. People who share information online, they don't have the luxury or the responsibility to do that. Remember, it's a general statement. I'm not saying everyone does that, but this is what we see. And that's scary, because today, if you don't have credible news, you are not getting information about your hobbies, interested topics, politics, anything, you name it. And by the way, I even go further. News actually helps build your social skills. It's an excellent topic. If you're at a dinner table and you don't have nothing to talk about, you pick up something from the news and you talk about it.
How about the suggestion as journalists that we focus too much on depressing news? Often people say that it's not news unless it's, you know, sad news or bad news, you know, about shooting. We don't report enough on the positive news stories out there. Do you think that maybe as journalists, we need to change our perspective on that?
So recently, a lot of study has been done in the U.S. Alone, where news networks are focusing on putting out more positive stories. As a matter of fact, at ABC7 in Detroit, which is also the local station, is WXYZ, we do emphasize a lot on positive stories. And, you know, positive stories are important, 100%. No one's denying that, because more and more the trend shows that people want to watch happy news. But at the same time, what's happening in our communities, what's happening around the world matters. And if we don't get that information, one could put an argument, ignorance is bliss, but for how long?
How about this idea that more than one in four young people aged 18 to 24 are now getting their news from social media sites like TikTok? And as a consequence, it must be in that, you know, quite fast-moving video bite-sized format. Is it the responsibility of journalists to go to where the audience is in order to speak to them?
And that's, once again, a new trend that we are also shifting towards. As a matter of fact, here, even in Dubai, many networks are also focusing on social media, trying to get that next generation involved in news, involved in authentic, correct news. And if you look at most networks, whether it's here or around the world, they will have the presence on TikTok, Instagram, X, formerly known as Twitter, and then Snapchat as well. And it's about how you present news to that audience. Because keep in mind, you know, there are certain audience who don't want to watch that kind of news. They prefer their traditional television. So I think it is our responsibility as our journalists to get information out there for each different group. But that's also challenging as well, because keep in mind, right, and if you've got only a certain hour in a day, certain amount of hours in a day to get that fact, to get that news, you know, captured on video, scripted, edited, and put it on air.
Yeah, and then your budgets are decreasing. It is an interesting conundrum, certainly for journalists. Thank you so much for joining us on the radio this morning. We're very lucky that you happened to be in the UAE at the time. Faraz Javed, a journalist and producer, formerly in Dubai, now, as you've just heard, over in ABC News Detroit, and a very recent winner of an Emmy for his live coverage of a campus shooting in Michigan in February last year. Faraz, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great pleasure.
The honour is all mine. Thank you very much.
It's such a relief that despite so many people finding the news depressing and switching off from it, we do still have people listening here to The Agenda. And it is that new global study that is our focus. It's by the Reuters Institute, and it shows that more people are turning away from news. They think it's depressing. They think it's relentless. They think it's boring. And we have been hearing from you guys. Dubai resident Ayman told us where he gets his news.
So I've completely stopped watching traditional news media. I don't watch CNN, BBC, anything like that. I get a lot of my news from the radio, actually Dubai 103.8, because I like to get local news. I get a lot of stuff through YouTube, TikTok, things like that. The algorithm has figured me out. And then I just go to the original sources, man. I try and like talk to people who are actually part of whatever events are going on and get the real down low, because unfortunately, like, I've seen how things can get easily twisted in media. A story can completely change depending on the wording and the way you say things and the timing. So many things.
Okay, Christoph also sent this message in on 4001.
From time to time, I check the Belgian news, news from home, but it makes me so depressed that I like to mix it up with Dubai, with local news platforms and social media, because I feel here in Dubai, they give optimism and positivity a chance.
We've had some lovely messages come in just now. In fact, as Sheikh Khattab says, I actually don't find it depressing at all listening to Dubai Eye's news updates, which are very progressive and optimistic. And he says, good morning, Georgia. I actually do get my news from Dubai Eye, as I think you will get the balance just right. Informative without sensationalist, and you don't just concentrate on the negative aspects as many news outlets do. It frustrates me when news organizations speculate with so-called experts' opinions, as that is not news. That was especially true during COVID, where Dubai Eye was, for me, a definite go-to to get important and irrelevant information, especially Serena's updates. We couldn't agree more on that point. Right, okay, let's get into the details of this survey. It does suggest that those who are still interested in the news are ditching the traditional media platforms for more websites like YouTube and your social media sites like WhatsApp and TikTok. One in four 18 to 24-year-olds, in fact, get their news from TikTok. Let's talk to a digital news expert to find out a bit more, because I'm delighted to say I'm joined in the studio now by Ahmed Al-Marzouki. He's a content creator and project manager for Emirates Loves. Now, I'm sure you've heard of them. They're a platform that creates content for all the different communities in the UAE. They mostly spread positive news, which is very interesting. Ahmed, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for interviewing me here today.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Tell me about the content you create at Emirates Loves. Are you, you know, and the communities that you're looking to, the audience you're hoping to attract?
Yes. Actually, Emirates Love is an online project, which is we want to create like the positive side effect that we are seeking to have. We have 16 pages related to 16 different nations, and we talk about culture in each and every nation about those countries. Sometimes we highlight news related to those countries and the Emirates. Of course, it's like Emirates Love Egypt, Emirates Love Syria, Emirates Love Iraq. So we have 16 pages related to 16 countries, as I said. We try to go away from politics. We don't talk about politics. We focus mostly on the positive things which are happening, like those kind of cultures, yeah. How they are living in the UAE, how they are living in harmony with different nations also.
Yeah, so a big focus on community stories, yeah. I guess, and that's the very definition of local news in many ways. I think you sound like one of our competitors, but that's okay. We like to have you on because you're the digital side of things. Why do you think people are being turned off by the news? Because, of course, it must be something you've seriously considered.
If you say the news on the TV or on the original news sources, I think they are kind of long and boring. especially those days, most of the people who are using social medias and like seeking to know more about the news, those news are youth. Most of them are on social medias. So even social media, even those kind of entities have turned to social media and tried to adjust with the changes that are happening in the world today. But it's a kind of hard thing because some people have already lost the trust of the local media sources.
So I worry, so there obviously trust is a huge element. And yes. I sometimes worry that if you're trying to make bite-sized news, you know, news that only lasts 30 seconds or a minute, there's no opportunities to really sort of dive into the complexity of a story. Does that worry you?
Yeah, that is one of the benefits, I say, with social media. So we have different platforms. Some platforms are made for long videos and long content, and some of them are for short content. And for the people who like to read, there is some platforms for reading those kind of contents as news. So you have different platforms with different, like I would say, algorithm that support long videos and some of them for short videos. But when you say like short videos, let's talk about short videos, which is basically what we work on actually in Emerald. It's really hard to like make a big news in a 1 minute video. We focus on 1 minute mostly. So we try to give the main points, of course, without like making it boring.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah, you have to have a structure to create that, like a hook in the beginning and a bite in the middle so people don't leave the video and continue to watch till the end. It's a kind of hard job, to be honest, but this is how the new audience love it.
Well, that's the thing. And we have to respond to what the audience wants ultimately to survive. And those 18 to 24 year olds who like those quick 1 minute bite interviews, maybe as they get older, might, you know, if they're hooked on news by that stage, then maybe they'll stick around for the longer stories. I mean, you've obviously done lots of studies on young people and their preferences in terms of consuming news. Yes. Are there certain stories that they just don't want to know about?
Most of the young people today, they want to hear about everything. But of course, people hate negativity.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we want to focus on the positive side. And that is why it's Emirates Loves. Because Emirates loves like the other nations that are living here. And sometimes good news, they have to be negative. So people like get interested and get angry and want to watch it till the end. And they comment, algorithm, of course, make it like go viral and stuff like that. So that is why Emirates Love focus on the positive side in our platforms. We want to spread awareness that sometimes negative news are like, they are not true. So yeah. We want to focus on the real stories and true stories. And
it's so interesting you say that, because you're quite right. People often attract attention by being very, very negative and putting out really quite nasty comments or nasty news or nasty opinions in the hope of catching clicks. Now, of course, you are an online site, but you're deliberately avoiding that type of content.
Yes, of course, we have to like avoid those kinds of content, but at the same time, we need to focus.
Mm-hmm.
And take those kind of comments on consideration, because sometimes maybe we did something wrong, but of course we don't. Of course, there's a long process on any content that we create. It goes to multiple approvals until it's released. So we need to make sure of the source. But sometimes, you know, when you are dealing with young people, it's sometimes hard to control the audience.
Mm.
So of course you will get negative comments eventually in social media. But you have to know how to deal with it,
yeah.
And you have to accept it, because you are dealing with different perspectives and different cultures and different point of views.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other big element, is people like to have their say nowadays. There needs to be a lot of interaction in news. People like to participate. Absolutely fascinating to speak to you. Thank you so much for coming in. We're really interesting to hear how sort of digital news works over at Emirates Loves. Ahmed Almazouki, lovely to have you in the studio. Ahmed is a content creator and project manager for Emirates Loves. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you in.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. Georgia here. And we're turning our attention away from news at the moment and how people feel about the news. But we are going to come back to it. And we're going to turn our attention instead to Hajj season. Millions of Muslims from around the world currently converging on Mecca. But this year, cybersecurity experts are warning that there's a heightened risk of online scams. Basically, cybercriminals are targeting individuals who are planning their pilgrimage. It's all according to a US-based security firm called ReSecurity. And they say that fake social media adverts are offering things like accommodation, transport, and even the securing of a sacrifice for pilgrims. So how can you protect yourself from getting scammed while planning your Hajj pilgrimage? Or in fact, you know, since most people have planned it by now, if you're actually on your pilgrimage. We're joined now by the author of that report, Ahmad Halabi. He is Managing Director of ReSecurity, joining me on Teams. Good morning, Ahmad. Lovely to have you with us. Can you sort of flesh out the detail a bit more on this? What type of scams are we seeing?
Good morning, Georgia. How are you? Thank you for having me here. Well, what happened is, you know, like every season and every event that criminals try to use the opportunity of, criminals and let's say fraudsters and threat actors try to use the Hajj season in order to defraud pilgrims and steal identities, money from them as well. So they did a couple of techniques in order to be able to achieve their goal, from impersonating the official Hajj domains, pages, applications like Nusuk that the Saudi government and Ministry of Hajj and Umrah launched recently. They also tried to create phishing domains, phishing pages, online registration scams, and also impersonate real logistics and travel agencies in order to fraud the real people that gonna do Hajj and steal their information from. So also on social media, they try to create a lot of phishing campaigns through generative AI. So they even used AI techniques in order to trick consumers and trick pilgrims in order to fall into these traps.
What would be your recommendation for people who, you know, they need to book their Hajj pilgrimage? How can they tell whether or not the website they're booking through is the real deal?
Yes. So for that, we provided a couple of takeaways and legitimate sources to check. First of all, you need to make sure that you're applying to the legitimate official domains and applications authorized by Ministry of Hajj and Umrah. And this is technically provided by the ministry. Now we know that it is a bit hard for normal pilgrims to identify the domain name, identify the application, because threat actors, hackers gonna also try to design the same logo, design the same name of the domain. But still, the best way to do so is to go to the official page of the ministry, download the official applications and only use them. And don't rely on third-party agency to book for you. Use a trusted third-party agency that is trusted, honest, and you worked with before in order to make sure that your Hajj trip will be, you know, perfect.
I'm interested by this idea that they are also fishing for data from Hajj pilgrims, because I understand the idea that if you, you know, put up a fake advert, a fake travel, advert, then you can just basically steal people's money. But what's going on with the fishing for data? How does that work?
Yeah, so, you know, like fraudsters like money, but also threat actors like data, because think about it, you can steal the data from your identity, your email, your password, your date of birth, your passport number, and you can sell this identity on the dark web and on the dark sources of the internet, which will also generate some income for them. So the idea is not just stealing money directly, but also stealing the identities, filtering them, selling them on the dark web, impersonating the owners, and then use them to attack further. So you're using these stolen identities to impersonate them and use them to attack other relevant and relationships they do have.
Really interesting to get your advice there. Thank you so much for your time. Ahmed Halabi there, Managing Director of ReSecurity, who brought out that report that suggests that there is a heightened risk of scams and fraudsters who are targeting individuals who are planning their Hajj pilgrimage. Fantastic to have you on the radio this morning, Ahmed. Thank you very much indeed. Hello, welcome back to The Agenda. Right, we're looking at this really interesting story. In fact, there's a lot of heat stories doing the rounds at the moment. I mean, I suppose it's obvious in some ways. It's summer and, you know, everyone's talking about climate change. But it turns out that there are some serious issues in the country next door because millions of Muslims from around the globe, of course, currently converging on Mecca for Hajj season, many of them departing from right here in the UAE. In fact, the team from Dubai Airport joined the Business Breakfast last week to explain how they prepare for the rush. This is Mohammed Al-Marzouki. He is head of the Hajj committee over at Dubai Airport.
There is a quota for UAE national. So from Dubai Airport itself, we'll have around 4,600 UAE national traveling to perform Hajj. The quota for the entire UAE is 6,200. So we've got the majority of passengers traveling from here. The transit passenger, however, it might reach more than 100,000.
Okay, but there are worrying figures now emerging from Saudi about the number of pilgrims who are struggling with heat exhaustion. Now, these figures have yet to be confirmed by the kingdom, but the various sort of foreign embassies in the kingdom suggest that more than 550 Hajj pilgrims have already died as temperatures in Mecca exceed 50 degrees inside the Grand Mosque. Now, this comes after a recent study by the Journal of Travel and Medicine found that rising global temperatures may outpace strategies to deal with the heat. And there was another study back in 2019 said that as temperatures rise in Saudi Arabia due to climate change, pilgrims performing Hajj will face extreme danger. Now, joining me to talk through this story, as well as the sort of the Hajj scam story that we touched on a little earlier, is Rikin Seth. He's Assistant Vice President of B2C Operations at the travel agency Musafir.com. Rikin, lovely as always to have you join us on the line. Now, we've been hearing a lot more about heat exhaustion this year. Is it a concern? Do your customers express a concern when they're booking holidays with you?
Absolutely. Good morning. It's always a pleasure to have to be on the show. And it's a very sensitive topic that you just spoke about, you know, in terms of the death cases that have happened in Saudi Arabia. And it's not only about Saudi Arabia. There's a heat wave across the globe. And specifically to Hajj. Hajj is a little different than Umrah. You know, like when people just go to Saudi Arabia, do the Makkah and Medina, 2 nights, 3 days, 3 nights, 4 days, and come back. But Hajj involves a series of rituals that pilgrims perform. And this could be over a period of, 15 to 20 days as well. So, you know, it is really important that people are made aware. And this is what, you know, we tend to inform our clients as well. Because temperatures of 45 to 50 degrees, it's not something which is very usual.
Yeah, you do need to be, you know, fit and healthy to be able to perform those Hajj ceremonies. And of course, that isn't always the case. Sometimes you have people who are elderly who want to perform Hajj, or people who are not in their, you know, their best fit, you know, best fit form kind of thing. I'm actually surprised that we're seeing such problems this year, because of course Hajj is gradually moving back towards spring, isn't it? Because it changes according to the Islamic New Year.
Yes, absolutely. It is usually performed during the Eid al-Adha, which was the last weekend. And I'm sure sitting in the UAE, we all understand what is the weather like at this point of time, especially during the daytime, right? So we've seen temperatures rise to about 49 to 50 degrees. But as you mentioned, you know, that about the elderly people who are actually going to perform Hajj, I think in addition to, you know, being hydrated, drinking plenty of water, wearing lightweight, loose-fitting clothing, maybe sunscreen, I think it is more important to educate the pilgrims about the signs and symptoms of heat exhaustion, you know, which is heavy sweating, weakness, dizziness, nausea, maybe headache and even fainting. So I'm sure, you know, there are a lot of medical facilities available, and it is very critical for them to know where these medical facilities are. And if there are any signs of these symptoms, they should immediately contact those medical groups.
Now, we've got around 1.8 million people performing Hajj this year.
Right.
It's a little bit less than last year. Have you had many bookings? Is it still as popular a trip as ever?
So Hajj is something which has to be done from your country itself. So, for example, Hajj is not something that an expat can do from the UAE, right? Because of the allocation of quota that is available, right? So as you mentioned earlier on the call, that about 4,500 UAE nationals went for Hajj this year. But I think there's a fair bit of allocation, fair bit of numbers coming in, let's say from countries like India, for that matter. Who are performing Hajj. So, and Hajj is something which only a few local agents are allowed to perform, who are actually authorized and registered as a part of the Saudi Arabia body.
Well, yes, and that is why I think maybe so many people are getting caught out by these scams centering around Hajj. Is it been it's been highlighted this year, but is it something that you've been aware of for some time?
Yes, absolutely. We have been aware of, and we have been, telling our friends and families as well, whoever we know that is going to perform Hajj, because there is a General Authority of Islamic Affairs and Endowments, which is called AFCAF, which is the regulated body through which only you get the allocation. So it is very critical that you don't fall into scam in terms of any agent trying to dupe you. Especially, you need to be very careful when you make payments through cash, because there is no way to track that kind of a scam, right?
I know that the rules to visit Saudi for Hajj are quite strict. I mean, obviously, you mentioned the allocation. Are there other documents that you're required to bring to perform a pilgrimage? Have the rules changed recently? I seem to think they have.
So basically, the agents who are authorized, they have allocations based on that. They have a separate visa. So you can't do a Hajj with an Umrah visa or the 1 year multi-entry Saudi visa that is currently available. So of course, there are documentation, and in addition to the Hajj visas, of course, you need your hotels and your flights and the other standard documents that are required as well.
Really?
But what is most critical is the Hajj visa document, which only the authorized travel agent has, who will be able to give you. And for that, you really need to plan at least a year in advance.
Wow. Okay, that is very interesting. I hadn't realised that it took so much preparation. Rickon, an absolute pleasure to have you join us on the line. Thank you very much indeed for covering all those elements of the Hajj pilgrimage. Really interesting to have you on the radio. Rickon Seth there, Assistant VP at Musafir.com, the travel agent. Really lovely to have you join us.
This is The Agenda on Dubai i 103.8,
with the Economic Security Centre of Dubai. Shared responsibility for a secure economic environment.
Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. Right. Are you going away this year? Are you travelling soon? I'm travelling. I'm trying to think how long it is now. I'm getting quite excited about it. Third week of July, I think I head off. And we are planning to go back to England to see the family, and then we're going to go to Mallorca. So I'm going to need pounds and I'm going to need euros. But how do I get that holiday money? It is, to be honest, an absolute minefield of fees and charges. And I never know whether I should be using a credit card, a debit card, whether I should use cash. And this came to a head slightly when we went to Kenya as a family, the last Eid break. For some reason, I had dollars. I had cash money. And there's not much we can do with dollars in this country. I suppose I could have paid them into the bank account. But because we had it in cash, we thought, I know, we'll change it. We'll exchange it into Kenyan shillings, I think it is. And but of course, we left that too late. And we suddenly realised we needed to do it when we were in the airport. And my husband went to the airport desk and exchanged a bunch of dollars. And it wasn't till afterwards, when he did the maths, that he realised he'd basically been robbed, how bad the exchange rate was. I mean, I think we were down like a quarter. I mean, I can't even believe how much we were down. All I can say is that my experience from that is it stings, and don't change your money at the airport. But that's the only advice I've got for you. And fortunately, we have managed to find an expert who can tell you a whole lot more. We've got Steve Cronin, financial independence coach, founder of Dead Simple Saving. And I imagine, I can't see his face right now, I look at the camera. I imagine he's cringing at the idea that I decided to change my money at the airport. That must be rule 101, Steve, of holiday money.
Hi there. Well, we've all been there, haven't we?
Yeah.
And fortunately, it's getting easier now that most places in the world accept cards, that you can just use your card. You know, that airport taxi or whatever, you just use your card and then it's a lot easier. I say if you have to change some money at the airport, then just change enough to get a taxi to your hotel or wherever you're going. And then you can always try to find a bank or an exchange place if you, you know, if you're really struggling with that. But certainly if you're going home, like, you know, if you're going somewhere like the UK or whatever, and you have a bank account in that country, then you just have to get your money back in the most efficient way possible, the best rate. And so exchange places like Revolut, Currency Fair, Wise, Interactive Brokers, these are going to be the most efficient.
So 9 times out of 10, if you go to a street-facing exchange shop, be that in the airport or near an airport, are you not going to get a great rate?
The airport's going to be particularly bad, and it probably makes sense. You know, if you're in the UAE, for example, you're not going to get a great rate on Kenyan shillings compared to being in Kenya and exchanging your dollars into Kenyan shillings. You know, there are quite a few. You know, you're in Kenya, so you're probably going to get a better rate, but just not at the airport. So please don't do anything at the airport unless you absolutely have to. But I think that the biggest thing that we're seeing at the moment is just people getting stung by fees, and that's what you have to really avoid. So if you're wandering around with your UAE debit card, you could quite easily get hit by ATM charges, you could get hit by foreign transaction charges, and you could get hit by bad exchange rates, and you really need to avoid all three.
Yeah, so that's what my husband and I find so difficult, because so you've got a choice. You can either go to the bank and get as much money as they'll let you get out, which often isn't really a great deal, you know, only really enough to last you a couple of days before you have to go back again. You know that they're charging you dodgy fees. You know that they're charging you exchange costs. But then the alternative is just to tap for every meal out. And then aren't you getting those transaction fees on every single payment rather than a lump sum? We can never decide whether to do it in a lump sum or whether to do it bit by bit.
Yes, and I think actually sometimes just taking the hit on the lump sum can be better, as long as your cash doesn't get stolen then subsequently. The good news is that places like WIO Bank, HSBC, and Revolut, they actually have cards that don't hit you with foreign transaction fees, don't hit you with foreign ATM charges, and have pretty good exchange rates. And so now you can go and use your card with impunity. The only caveat to that is that the risk of your card getting hacked is pretty high, almost wherever you go at the moment. So I wouldn't keep too much money in the account that you're using, just enough for your holiday, or keep transferring money into that so that if it does get emptied, it's annoying, but it's not a disaster.
When you say that they can get hacked, are they more likely to get hacked than your normal debit card?
No, all debit cards are vulnerable. And
oh, okay.
We've seen that at the moment, just a massive surge in card fraud in the past month. It's actually quite insane. And so if you need to, just lock your card on your app until you need to spend money. And beware ATM machines, for example. There are card skimmers. We don't really see that in the UAE, but they can literally skim your card details and record you pressing the buttons on the ATM. So we see that quite a lot in Europe. So do be careful. But I think the biggest like institutionalized scam is when you get to a shop or you get to the duty free at the airport and they say, would you like to pay in the local currency?
Yes.
Or would you like to pay in your home currency? And you say, oh, well, you know, I know my home currency. Let's do that. And that's how they get you. So you need to always pay in the local currency. And then your nice, friendly bank in your home country of, you know, UAE will be giving you an okay rate, whereas if they do the exchange, then they will give you a horrible rate. So always pay in the local currency.
I need to think of some sort of rhyme, you know, a sort of there's another word for it that reminds me that that is always the case, because 9 times out of 10, my husband and I will stand next to each other at a till and go, what are we meant to do? Or at the end of a meal, you know, when you've had a long holiday meal, you get to the end and you're like, which one is it? Is it, do we pay in dirhams or do we pay in the local currency? I need to, there must be some way to lock it into my head that it's always local.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, you'd have to say like, stay local, or when in Rome.
Yes.
Pay in euros or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, just
lock it in. Pay local. Lock it in. Or like, yes. There must be some, because honestly, I can't tell you. You know, both of us university educated. My husband used to be a banker, and we still cannot get it right. You know, and every time we're at the till, you know, I'm buying some dreadful pair of earrings that I'll only wear on holiday, and before we know
confession
it, we've
time
been
now.
Yeah, I know, it's all coming out now, and we'll be stung by it. Steve, as always, fantastic to get your advice. Thank you very much indeed. Somebody here has texted it. Is it right that we should always pay with credit card, not debit card, on holiday?
I don't mind. If you're buying flights, it helps to buy on your credit card, because then you have an extra level of protection if your flight or your hotel room gets cancelled for some reason. But I'm not too bothered, as long as you're not getting ripped off on fees. And usually the low fee cards are debit cards. Just, I would make sure that it's not your current account, ideally, that it's not a current account that you use for everyday business in the UAE and all your bills are coming out of it, because there is a greater risk of it getting hacked. But just, I would just avoid the charges. I think that's the most important thing.
Steve Cronin, always lovely to have you join us on the radio. And you certainly got us prepped for our holiday spending. So thank you very much indeed. So if you want more advice from Steve, do check out his website. He's a financial independence coach and the founder of Dead Simple Saving.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. Right, we're going to turn our attention to what is a very sensitive story here for us in the UAE, and specifically for us here on Dubai Eye 103.8, because it has now been a year since that Titan submarine was destroyed on a mission to the wreck of the Titanic. Now, 4 lives were lost, including the explorer Captain Hamish Harding, who was based in the UAE, and he was a regular guest right here on the Agenda programme. In fact, he came on the Agenda in the days before he left for that fateful trip and told us all about how excited he was about it and how they were really pushing the boundaries of science. And as you can imagine, we followed every twist and turn of the story, as did the rest of the world. It really, you know, caught the attention of everyone, really, because there were days and there were concerns that they could still be alive in the sub and awaiting rescue. And it was a really agonizing wait. It was, you know, it was a pretty awful time in many ways. I mean, for everyone involved, you know, even here at the radio station, we only knew Captain Hamish Harding as a guest on the show. You can only imagine how agonising it must have been for his friends and family. And it did eventually emerge that the sub had imploded at around the same moment that its mothership lost contact. So it was an instant loss. Now, since then, many questions have been asked about the safety of these types of submersibles, understandably, and indeed the exploration of the deep ocean. Although enthusiasts, like, for example, the Titanic filmmaker James Cameron, are very keen for it to continue.
Exploration will proceed because it must, and because it's part of the human spirit. We have plans to build a sub that can go to 4,000 meters, and we will. I may even go back to Titanic in that sub, just to prove the point that if it's done right, it can be done safely.
That is James Cameron speaking just recently in a film that was made over in Australia. Now, we want to go into the details of this in a little bit more, get a bit more analysis ultimately. And joining me now to discuss that work is Professor Alistair Greig. He's a Professor of Marine Engineering at University College London, joining us now on Teams. And we actually spoke to you last, Professor Greig, back when... of course, this submarine, you know, this Titan sub was sort of missing and no one knew what was going on. So thank you so much for joining us 1 year later. Is it possible to explore the depths of the ocean safely?
Yes, it is. But like all exploration, all missions, yeah, there's always a risk associated with it. I mean, if you look, for example, people going into space, we've had some very tragic disasters there as well. But people have continued to go into space and people continue to want to go into space. But it's all about doing the process properly and safely and trying to minimize those risks.
Various details have sort of since emerged about what this Titan sub was made out of. For example, maybe certain safety checks were skipped over. Obviously, there are ongoing investigations into the Titan sub itself, but there is some information in the public domain, and it does sound like it was different to normal submarines.
It was certainly a different design in many respects, and also from what I understand, that it didn't have full independent review of the design and the vessel itself.
What do you traditionally need to see in a submarine that goes down to these depths? You know, what are the actual dangers that you're facing? It's the pressure, isn't it?
The pressure is the main thing, yes. And also, as we saw, if you're down at those depths, it's very difficult to get any aid down there quickly. But the pressure is the real danger and is very unforgiving.
Yeah, and in order to do that, what are most of these submarines made out of? You know, what are the safety nets that are traditionally implemented?
They're made out of various materials, they have to be very strong materials, and also materials that can be easily inspected. Because if you repeatedly dive, obviously you're putting on very extreme stresses on the material. So you want to be quite sure that after a dive, it is still as good as it was when it was first made.
I mean, we heard the filmmaker James Cameron talking about why he wants to go down to depths, you know, far further, you know, right down to 4,000, was it metres? I think it must have been metres, below the surface. I mean, obviously, you can imagine why James Cameron wants to do it. You know, he's an adventurer, he's a filmmaker. But are there practical reasons for why people need to go down to that depths?
Certainly scientific reasons. I think we know very little about the deep ocean, very little indeed. In fact, we know less about parts of the deep ocean than we do the surface of the moon. For example, the Malaysian aircraft that was lost, we still haven't found it. It's somewhere in the deep ocean, but we can't find it. And of course, if we're thinking about issues of global warming, we really do need to understand what's going on in the ocean and all the way from the top to the bottom, what's going on with the currents there. There are species down there that we really don't know very much about at all, and we're still discovering species at the deep depths.
And so as far as oil and gas as well, do we need these submarines in order to explore possible underwater resources as well?
Not so much oil and gas. Oil and gas is sort of much shallower depths, maybe down to just the continental shelf, a couple of hundred metres, not sort of 3,000 or 4,000. I mean, the Titanic's down about 3,800 metres. But what is of interest down there is nodules of minerals like manganese and potentially some other very valuable minerals. And there's a lot of discussion about mining these and the potential damage they could do to the local ecosystems.
Yeah, actually, that is a topic that we've discussed a fair amount here on the agenda, mostly from the point of view of the conservationists who are very concerned that, it's effectively strip mining where you just sweep the bottom of the ocean in order to pick up these nodules. I suppose if you had the submarines down there, you could potentially do it in a more sort of precise manner.
Well, at least you'd have some idea of what you're doing rather than just going down there completely blindly.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Absolutely fascinating to realise that there is so much yet to be explored in the deep oceans on Earth. So thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line. Professor Alistair Grieg there, Professor of Marine Engineering at University of College London, bringing us up to date on the continued exploration of the deep oceans.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And if you enjoy this podcast, please do click subscribe so you never miss a single episode. Plus, remember, you can always get in touch with us. Just check out our social media. You can either go to Dubai Eye 103.8 FM, that's on Instagram or Facebook, or you can check mine out at georgia.tolley. Thanks for listening. And remember, we are live every weekday morning from 10 a.m.